Hello, and welcome to French Tech News with Chris O'Brien and Ethan Pierce, an audio and video podcast series highlighting important stories in English in the world of France's startups, its entrepreneurs, investors, and ecosystem leaders. Our objective is to continue to open this incredible ecosystem up to the Anglophone startup and investment community worldwide. And speaking of the podcast and all of our past discussions and interviews, head on over to your preferred podcast platform and search for French Tech News and give that a subscribe, as well as the video podcast on YouTube. I would like to welcome our guest today, Quentin Nickmans, who is the founder and managing director of eFounders, as well as my co-host in this French Tech News journey, Chris O'Brien. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. Good to be here.
I am looking forward to today's discussion about eFounders, and I guess kind of to dive right in. Last year, eFounders celebrated its 10th anniversary. It's been quite an amazing ride when we look at all the amazing things that have been built. You've launched 30 startups, raised over $400 million, if I'm correct, and two of those are now worth over $1 billion and are officially unicorns, Aircall and Spendesk. So I guess let's start then with the basics and go back to that. What is eFounders? What do you do exactly? How does this thing work?
So the definition of eFounders is a studio. Some people also call that a venture builder. So it's in the area of the accelerators, incubators initially. When we started, the concept of studio in 2011 was not existing. A studio is atypical because it's built its own companies or own ideas. We basically think about a concept, an idea. We focus quite a lot on SaaS and productivity for SMB SaaS over the last years. And once we get an idea, we wireframe it quite a lot. And then we partner up with entrepreneurs saying, hey, do you really like it? Also, and we basically then build out a project with them for a bunch of months. That's more generally 12 to 18 months. And once everything is on green light, we get some traction. The idea seems to be, and the product seems to be having a positive signs of becoming or have the ability to become a real independent venture, we incorporate the company and it lives completely independently out of the studio.
So let's kind of jump back in time, because you mentioned, you sort of hinted there that at the time, I guess 2011, this model didn't necessarily exist, or at least not here in Europe. So how did you kind of develop this model? Was it something that sort of came to you in a flash and you thought, oh, here's how we could do a whole venture studio? Or did it start differently and then it's just kind of evolved into this method?
I think like usually it's an entrepreneurial adventure that starts because people want to do something. And when I say the studio concept wasn't existing, I think the first time the studio word came out is BetaWorks or something like that developed it in 2014 or stuff like that. It's like a repetitive entrepreneurship by building in teams. That is exactly the definition of how you could do a studio. And it's more Thibaut and myself, we met in end 2010, early 2011. And instead of investing as angels and being very active on ideas of other people, especially Thibaut at that time had like two or three ideas and said, hey, but why don't we build them? And then we partner up with some people. We give them a lot of equity at that time, not as much as we give now. And then we say, we'll see where it goes, right? The real model evolved so much over time in Europe on our side, but also in the US. We discussed obviously a lot with our counterparts that we crafted over the years and we learned a lot on how a model like that can be and successful and economically viable.
Obviously, software as a service, SaaS companies are kind of everywhere today. It's kind of one of the most attractive business models, I think, in the startup space. What was going on, really, if we go back to that 10-year point and the beginning of this, that encouraged you to really make this bet on the idea of SaaS startups and software as a service? What took you down that road specifically that this would be, as you were learning what could be the profitable or economically viable version of this idea of a studio, what brought you to that point?
Maybe a couple of factors. First, we had experience of entrepreneurship, both Thibault and myself, so we were conscious that a repetitive, recurring revenue business model creates a lot of value, right? You get a lot of metrics out of there. You can quite fast calculate if you get positive and good traction on your business. How much does it cost to acquire a customer? What's the churn level of the customers over time? So what's the lifetime value? We learn quite fast that you can predict a model in SaaS in a better way, even at the early stage, than a marketplace where you get a moat business, where you get a certain size of the supply or demand you need to reach before you can really say it can be a real success, right? So overall, first, just the model of recurring revenues and the metrics you can analyze out of that makes it quite predictable, which makes you at ease to develop a bunch of startups and feel they're in positive or negative traction model. Secondly, we do focus on SMBs, like 50 to 1,000 companies. So it's high velocity sales. We don't need to work with enterprise sales for 6 months or whatever. So what we like is that we knew these type of companies, having either built some of them before. Thibault did Futuria. I did a bunch of other projects before. I was also a consultant in my previous life. So we knew about these SMBs companies, what they could be a problem over there. And so we could feel what type of problems that we could tackle and we faced in the past. SMB type of place. And SMBs, the fun stuff with that is that you can do marketing also and sales, right? You can have what it calls today more product-led growth, what I call real marketing offensive to get traction in sales. Or if it's a more detailed, focused persona you need to reach in the SMB world, you can do just direct sales and talking about them. And when you looked at all this, there were lots of opportunities when we looked at the SMB business where they were not served by these type of softwares. It's just the beginning of the cloud service for SMBs. So you looked at bigger companies that deployed legacy systems or tools that were efficient in digitalization, but nothing existed for the SMB space, right? And then whenever we were building, we were also discovering new problems we could tackle, right? We started with a PR management company. We needed to reach out to thousands of people or journalists and send blast emails. Hey, maybe there is a transactional email service that is useful so we can track who opens these emails, how much time they are engaged with it, etc. From there on, you learn that, hey, we want to spread in different countries. We want a local presence. We want to have a phone number a little bit everywhere in every country. At that time, we really like to localize in every European country the website and say, hey, translation service, how do you do that? How do you do translation over API service? That's how we built on TextMaster, right? Which was an over API translation service. And we said, hey, but for TextMaster, we needed people like in every country of Europe, right? And say, to moderate the different languages. These people need to have local phone numbers or need to have also a phone system. Say, hey, out of a company out of Paris, how can we open phone lines in every country in Europe? It's complicated, right? It's the beginning of the thought process about an air call. And so you just learn the different pain points by building, by being in the stuff. It's very different than an investor when you're down to earth building stuff, seeing how complicated things can be as a startup builder. That's really the story in the beginning for four or five first countries, problems identified in our previous adventures and by building the new ones.
So I love that because the very often in the story of a company and why a founder is working on that particular solution, it's because that's a pain point that they had encountered in their career or in their previous job or whatever. So that's what they want to solve. I absolutely love the fact that the genesis of so many of these amazing companies at eFounders was because those were the problems you were having. As you were building other companies, each time you found a problem, you just spun out a company. So it's that same concept, just taken to another level, and is really, it seems like the secret behind so many well-scaled companies, because they were founded in a real problem that scaled in the sense of enough people had the same problem. That's great.
Exactly. For me, it's exactly that, right? Spendesk is initially was called PayX, but we were starting 4 or 5 projects at that time. And as we have an independent model, right, we like to provide to the founders initially a lot of autonomy. There is no playbook of tools and what web hoster they need to choose or whatever. They can choose and do whatever they. I hand over a credit card to them from my bank, right? Saying, you're responsible. This is your card. Use the tools, the software, whatever you want to need. Just at the end of the month, give me the slips of everything that's related to that credit card because I need to put that in my accounting, right? And so we said, why is there any software piece where we can just adapt and give more freedom that is not just one owner that needs to pay all the bills and have the accounts and chasing all these teams? All these were the beginnings of the thought process around Spendesk. And so, you know, I explained to you how we came to Aircall. I can explain how we can do Spendesk. And then once you're just in that industry, you see the trends, you see the new type of technologies that emerge that makes it possible to do it differently. I mean, we couldn't have built Aircall in 2011, right? There was no Foxbone, there was no Plivo, or Twilio was not that evolved and not reliable. WebRTC was not existing in your browser, so it was not possible. It's the convergence of the right moment, the right idea at that time that makes it, hey, why not? Let's try it. And obviously, we just do the first initial beginnings. It's all these projects evolve, and after 12 months into our studios, the founders know the market and the clients and the product roadmap like tens of thousands better than we do, because they're just much more into the front line of what needs to be developed that creates value.
Well, let me just follow that a little bit then. So have a good sense of sort of how you're generating these ideas. We've talked to, you know, we've gotten this perspective from some of those founders about how this process works. But in terms of that next step you're describing, you know, they've talked a lot about a little bit about the process of choosing the founders. And I know even on your website, you know, you have a call for founders. You have a process where I could, in theory, Ethan and I could, you know, apply to be considered as founders of some next project down the line. But how do you then sort of match up and find the right people? And then once you do, how does that 12-month, 18-month period work in terms of kind of finding the team or finding the idea to the point where you kind of, in a sense, push it out into the world?
So first, we cannot, we need to match an idea with generally a couple of people, a business and a technological, a tech founder, because we build software, which is a high component of tech, right? It seems very easy. First, an idea needs to be well thought. That means we write out a memo and we build a wireframe. Without that, it's just in the air, right? It's a memo where you say, this is the pain point and this is how we will resolve this. And we think the market is huge to tackle it. Because the idea needs to be concrete enough. If you want to talk to someone, if you too want to partner up to build a new company, it will be more than the idea. Somewhere you need to take the pen and paper and read it down. What concretely do we want to do? Really, physically, what's the start? What do we do? So building a wireframe and a memo is the critical piece necessary before we go to founders to talk about these ideas. We talked about these ideas totally publicly to everyone. A value and an idea is worth nothing. It's only the execution that counts. So having said that, we meet lots of founders. It's probably a third or more of our time of each of the founding partners, Thibault, Amaury, myself, meeting a lot of people. We learn a lot about their pain points and their ideas and their preferences, but also we talk about these ideas. Like, hey, we think about something and we treat this. This is how we think about it. And you see how much it hooks. The idea being worth nothing, you need to pair the fact you like a person first, and you will work together for probably 10 years. We will continue to work first very intensely in the studio, then at board level, we just become friends. And, you know, I knew Olivier Paillès for a while before already we started the company together. So you have the personal match, and then you have the match about the idea, right? Olivier, Mathilde, Rodolphe from Spenix, they need to also feel they would like to work on this idea and they like the pain point. And so you have a lot of reasons why it wouldn't make a match. Someone can be a brilliant founder, but if he doesn't feel that idea is worth taking 10 or more years of your life working on that, it's not worth it. So then the third part is then once we have the first founder, which is really hooked on the idea, we start building it. We look for the third co-founder, right? That's the model we have called the third co-founder, because the technical founder then, or the business founder, as we find the technical founder first, needs to match between them also. It's not that easy. It's completely, some people think it's a well-thought funnel, you know, organized process, which is not at all, right? We could start three projects now in March because things just align. The ideas, people fall in love, it just works. And then sometimes for 6 months, it just doesn't match. That's life, right? There is nothing really as a playbook of the 26 of the process that needs to be done. It's not at all that way that a studio, at least at our place, is organized.
So obviously things kicked into high gear last year with a lot of fundraising coming in. We talked about at the beginning, I mentioned the companies have raised over $400 million, and I believe $300 million of that was just last year. Could maybe talk to us a little bit about what that journey looked like then, and then how did eFounders really, what did that change in your model, if it did, or how did you have to adapt to the fact that these companies have scaled so significantly, they've raised so much money, they're worth so much money? You build and launch these things, but do you also play a role in kind of the management of them after they're kind of born and they're growing? Because now they've really turned into some impressive high growth companies.
So did it change anything? No, the answer is quite easy. We are not a fund. So we are a evergreen holding company with not that much shareholders. So it doesn't change anything. Our core business and 90% of what we're doing is building the stuff that might come out as big companies in 4 or 5 years. The vintage year of AirCall is 2014. So we started building, so it starts when we say it's 2014, it's the moment we really are wireframing and write that memo, right? That is the moment where we say, this is a project of that vintage year that we founded. And I think Front was 2015 or something like that. So it's fantastic that Spendesk 216, Front 214 have like that fantastic unicorn status. Obviously, very proud that these founders who get all the credit built out from that initial idea, such a great company, such a great culture, and executed that brilliantly over time. But we have obviously accepted the ignition, and to match these people, our role is top to that. Obviously, we're board members. We continue to invest into these companies. Financially, it's not obviously important because we're building the wealth of our model. But operationally, it doesn't change anything except that we can run great parties.
Wonderful. And just to follow up on that question a bit. So, you know, once they kind of do move into that independent state, is eFounders then essentially like a partial or major shareholder? Is that kind of the model that you have a set stake that you retain in each of these companies?
So the model is quite easy. When we create the company, we basically have a stake into a company with a minority stake by default. We have the ability to continue to invest like any other VC firm or firm, which we have been doing in over time as an evergreen holding. We prefer investing except in our own, let's say, companies we know very well. We know from very long years. We don't need to do due diligence to know if AirCall is doing great or not, right? We're not external investors. We're just into the stuff. So the independence for us is they take their offices. We have no any operational link anymore, except the board member seat, which we have almost in all our companies, except when other investors ask, typically for Front, for example, it's a complete US board. They say it's just way too complicated to organize with the European. Let's do it with Alicante, right? Otherwise, in all our companies, we're just present on the board. Besides our founders, we know them very well, and we enjoy the journey.
Well, if I could then just ask you, I don't know why that just popped into my head, but just to ask you a little personal question then. It made me think about something about myself, which is, you know, I've been a journalist for 30 years, and I was only once an editor for 1 year at my college paper, and I was a terrible editor because I would think up all these ideas for stories and I would assign them to my journalists. But then all I could think of was, I just want to go do the stories myself. You know, it was hard to let go of them and just say, okay, you go do the story and I'll accept what you're going to do. Do you guys ever feel that with these ideas? You sort of put them out into the world and there's a part of you that thinks, I really like to, you know, this is the one I could really see myself jumping into the CEO seat and really taking this all the way.
It's a great question, and it's a very relevant question. I think it's probably the. I'll tell you two or three things. Number one, you know, if you're a studio founder and you're very happy as a studio founder, if it doesn't hurt too much when the company leaves, because you get more energy in the new company and the new idea that is about to start than the company that's an 8-10 man company that's getting to independence and get to work and it spreads out. But obviously, it's very hard. The reality, you're extremely proud. It's like it's like parents having kids leaving the nest at 18 or 20, and then parents you don't really care about, they know everything better than you do or whatever, and they go out. But it feels like the same, right? I'm also a dad, so it feels like the same. But you get so much energy by building new stuff that you know that you have more energy by building new stuff than remaining involved with. It makes me think of, we worked with Camille, and in the first years, I made the math, right? In the first year, we were building one or two companies a year, and we were two or three partners. So in the end, it's like building one a year. We're now at the rhythm of building more 4 or 5 projects a year. So it took us time to get more on the serial side, right? Because it took time for us in the first years to leave them into independence. In the first companies, we were very much involved, even in the shareholder agreement, saying, hey, at every moment, the founders can ask Quentin or Thibault to come and continue to help into the company. It created itself by model over time. So A, it's hard. And you know if you're a good studio founder if you get more energy by starting a new one. Secondly, sometimes by building yourself, you also learn a lot and you get a new energy. My partner, Thibault, has been now working on Folk for a while as part-time CEO besides his work. He just needed it, right? He just says, I feel I need it because it brings me closer to what it is about building, very close to what the problems of a CTO, recruiting, whatever are. And it generates also new ideas and stuff. The only thing you need to do in life is feel where you work and you get energy, right? So we don't say we'll never do it. If you feel you get the energy to do it, but we're not meant to stay. It's from day one very clear, we're not meant to stay. That's just the deal everyone knows. And the third element to answer that question is we partnered up last year with Camille Thion to launch more fintech companies. We might talk about that later, how we think about all that. Camille's first company is called Numeral. It's a great success. It's great founders. And we have discussions with Camille to help him also say, now you need to free up time to think about the next company and the next project. Because he's deeply involved. He deeply loves the company so much. I think if you ask him the question, he might say, well, maybe I could continue work for Numero. But his idea being, I want to build a fintech studio. He knows that's the difficult moment where he needs to leave the founders alone in their own governance and make their own errors. And you will never be very far. Like, parents are never very far from their kids.
Well, in fact, that was going to be my next question, because I think I talked to Kemi. It was about a year ago, yes, that you officially announced. You've been working on it for a bit, but you publicly kind of announced Logic Founders, the sort of fintech version of what you've been doing. So you talked a little bit about it. It sounds like he's just getting ready to he's been developing the first company there. But any other updates and any other things you've learned from kind of now starting your first sort of adjacent venture studio?
Yes, there's lots to talk about that. But so the way we think about all this is, Camille is just the best person I know that I would take as a fintech founder to help me build and enhance my odds to success building a fintech company. He's built Payplug. He knows a lot of stuff. He's been an investor in a bunch of companies. He is deeply involved. And you just have a co-founder who's there for the first 12 to 18 months with a lot of experience, challenging a lot of dimensions. And it's great. Why does then Kemi wants to partner with eFounders is that we've built over time a reputation for recruiting best talent and practice. We're really a recruiting engine in for that sense. For the very first people that join a company, right? We were extremely demanding on that, and we see a lot of people. We get a reputation of doing stuff in a certain way, and it's like when you have a consultancy firm or an investment banking firm, it's a reputationally driven business. The good people and the good founders somewhere cross the roads of brands that they want to work with in a way or another, right? It's a quality stamp that has evolved over time. And so we try to manage that virtuous circle very carefully. And clearly, we have a full back office team now where Camille wants to build out a fintech studio. It's like 95% of his time. He doesn't care anything about the finance, the office, the stuff, the recruiting, whatever. That's all taken care of. That is what we now need to do. And the way Thibaut, myself, and my partners think about it is that core layer above that facilitates the studio models, we can scale that. We can't scale building more companies that people and myself 4 or 5 a year. But what we can scale is the way we make it for other experts and studio founders to facilitate their dream of building a studio. Because to be honest, building a studio is really a shitty model, right? It's a very complicated model. You're a tiny shareholder. It's not a fun model, so it's difficult to finance it. And it's easy to say now it's great success after 10 years, but it's a very long period of time to wait to see the real successes come out of it, right? So I don't encourage someone to start a studio except if he's really a robust person. And I wrote things about how to finance a studio, etc. It's complicated. It's not an easy journey. It's easier to do a VC fund.
So continue kind of down that road then. In a Medium post, you talked about launching other studios in health, artificial intelligence, blockchain. Any updates or further insights there?
We're exploring first project around with Tree because we meet people. It's more about meeting people, right? It's like we meet founders. Some people say, hey, why don't we think about it? And then obviously it also needs to be a dimension we love, but we're interested in health and we meet about people in health. We have been meeting people about Web3 or blockchain. We could meet people in food tech, in whatever. The only area where we limit ourselves or we put, let's say bandwidth, it needs to be software and preferably B2B because that is the roots and the core where we feel we are sure to have value add and pipeline of talents that we can really help a new venture to spread out.
So should we expect any announcements this year about New Venture Studios?
Yeah, if we're successful, if we're not, you know, a lot of projects we started, you never heard about because they're just killed into the studio. We're trying. We're a lab, right? So you basically hear about these new ventures when they come out of the studio. In the meantime, we have a lot of ideas. We check it out. We see, and then they don't come live. Might be the same about the studios. It will be more about meeting with great, brilliant people. We say, hey, do you really want to create like one or two ventures a year? And we'll facilitate having them their own team to replicate, in my words, maybe how Thibaut and myself started to scale into 11 to 12 when we were a team of four or five. And we that's where we started two, three companies a year. It's a real great setup. We call that a studio squad, right? We have the general team, which is the HR, the finance, the legal, the recruitment, the communications and all that stuff. But the squad was dedicated, focused on building, is not the same when you do future of work. It's different when you do fintech, and it's even more different when you do Web3 stuff. So that's how we think about it. We'll see if it succeeds.
Well, and then I want to just circle back on one thing we've kind of been talking about throughout this conversation, but just to maybe finish on this point, you know, you've made it pretty clear putting together that founding team is kind of key ingredient for this whole process, and you guys have developed a sort of methodology there for doing that. And again, I've heard those stories on the other side from some of those eFounder companies about, you know, the process they went through of meeting some other potential people, seeing what gelled, what didn't gel. But I'm wondering, so for anyone listening, you know, whether they're coming through a venture studio or whether they're just starting their own startup on their own, you know, putting together that founding team is crucial. So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about what you found to be some of the keys in those dynamics to making a successful founding team, or things that you look for that tell you, yes, this is the right mix of people to really take this idea forward.
It's a complicated one because, yes, it's extremely important, but every couple of founder, every couple of person linked to a project is so different. The culture of these companies, the way they craft it, is so different. When you talk today to Rodolphe from Spendesk compared to Olivier Zerpol or Mathilde's France, they're companies with different cultures, mindset, whatever, because it's crafted by these people. What we try to do is we try to work with people we identify as brilliant and we really like, right? Obviously, we build software. There is a lot of analytics. There is a lot of web love. You need to be a product-minded person. And it's more matching. I don't know if you say it in English, but how you make mayonnaise, right? It's just a bunch of ingredients. And at some point, you don't know what happens. And it turns out to become a mayonnaise. There is it's craftsmanship. There is no process. It's not about, hey, this guy needs to be an engineer with 3 years of grade. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And sometimes, to be completely honest, it doesn't work even down the process. Our philosophy has always been the project matters first. If one of the two founders in the end said, you know, I don't feel, I will dedicate the next 8 or 10 years on that problem. I just feel like I don't sleep well or whatever. And we say, well, never mind. We can have the robustness of continue that project, even if a founder for a moment is not there and there needs to be a VP engineering that comes to manage instead of a business founder. It exists and it happened. As much as it happened, as I think, in all other regular startups, there is one person that made the analogy, and I think it's Robin Waters at some point, he said, building out a company out of a studio is like an in vitro fecundation of a child, right? Would you be able to say whenever the child is born, how he has been made? No, right? So the process is so much similar to a regular way of matching people on a not too stupid idea, matching great people on a not too stupid idea, and to enhance the odds of success by doing it with a multidisciplinary team around them, dedicated with competences that you probably could not afford from day one. That is the ingredient to make it an above average area of success, right? It needs to be a not too bad idea. It needs to be brilliant people in execution for the stuff. And we need to deliver by doing the right choices to avoid major pitfalls. But for the rest, it's exactly the same as any other company.
Well, this was fascinating, super inspiring to get to learn about the ways that you've built this and the thought process put in everything. And I think I'll be listening to it again myself just because I found it to be absolutely fascinating and excellent. So thank you. Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Quentin, for taking the time to be with us today and sharing how you've built eFounders.
Thanks for having me, and great moment.
Yeah, it was a pleasure for me as well.
Thank you to our listeners for joining us for this episode of the French Tech News. Want more news and stories from France's incredible innovation ecosystem and its entrepreneurs? Subscribe to the French Tech News with Chris and Ethan on your preferred podcast platform and switch on notifications to be informed of new episodes as soon as they are released. You can connect with Chris and me on Twitter and LinkedIn. I'm at Ethan Pierce, that's ethanpierse, and Chris O'Brien is at obrien. Let us know if there are guests that you would like to see on the interview podcast, as well as any stories that we should take a look at. As always, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.